and welcome to Season 2, Episode 1 of Theology and Sci-Fi, the podcast. I am your host, Derek V. Trout, and it is so good to be back with you. I had a nice break, took a week off, a couple weeks off from the normal schedule here and how episodes are released, but I missed this. I missed the study, I missed the preparation, I missed the recording, I did not miss the editing, but that's part of what needs to happen to be here, so that's necessary. So this is where we are, but I was excited to get back and realize that after taking a break and then going and reading some of these short stories and starting to watch TV episodes for some to pick for the season, I started to get excited again. I started to realize how much I missed this and really, truly how much I've enjoyed this. So thank you for coming along on this ride with me. I truly, truly appreciate it and want to thank you for listening. We continue to grow in numbers and it's pretty cool to check the numbers and to see that. And to see what is happening. So thank you for that. I'm excited for the season, the slight change of where we are, shifting from looking at novels and movies to looking at short stories and TV show episodes. It's what I have called a season of shorts. And if you've been following me on social media, you've seen the new updated logo. It's pretty sweet. I'm excited about that. I have to say a big thanks to my cousin for doing that for me. I can't give you too much about who he is or anything like that. It's kind of funny because he listens to this podcast. So at one point, he told me that I was giving out too much information. I had given out my name and the state that I live in, and that was just too much because some people could probably track me down. I'm like, who's going to need to track me down? So anyway, my cousin did that. I can't tell you his name or what state he lives in because that'll be too much information, and somebody will somehow get him on the grid. He is literally probably the only person I know between the ages of 20 and 50. I'm going to give you a wide age range there because I don't think that will upset him too much. But he's probably the only person I know between the ages of 20 and 50 who does not have a cell phone. He's not even going on the grid in that way. Not interested in it, doesn't want to do it, never has had one, probably never will have one, so I don't want to give too much away and put him on the grid in any kind of way that he might feel uncomfortable with. So I just want to say thanks to my cousin for that. An incredible drawing and a really cool logo to be able to use for this season. Season 2, a season of shorts. So not a lot's going to change, just a little bit in what we're looking at, TV shows and short stories instead of looking at novels and movies. But Season 3, if we get there, there's going to be some big changes to come, and I'm really excited about that. I'm an idea guy. I look ahead. There's some things that I have ideas for. I'm more of an idea guy than a put in time, commit, record, edit, publish kind of guy. So this has really been a work of discipline for me, and it continues to be. I have more ideas for podcasts, books, and stories. Ideas, I have plenty of. Forming those ideas and making them something that goes from my mind to something in the real world, now that is a struggle. So this truly has been a discipline for me to be able to take a thought and actually make that thought become something that's a reality. So this is something that is a discipline and continues to be a discipline for me. But today we're going to look at a short story by an author that we have already examined on this podcast, Isaac Asimov. And that short story is titled Nightfall. A couple things. First of all, what is a short story? Well, according to the Hugo Awards, a short story is a story that is less than 7,500 words, so less than 7,500 words. And then they also have categories for a novelette, which is between 7,500 words and 17,500 words. Then they have a novella, which is between 17,500 words and 40,000 words. And then they have a novel, and they define novel as anything over 40,000 words. This might help to just kind of get an idea of how many words are in a book. So looking at two works from last season, The Martian Chronicles is about 65,000 words, right around there, 65,000. And Frankenstein is right around 41,500-ish. So that kind of just gives you a range, an idea of how long those books are and what that means. Second, and here we start to get into the short story we will be examining today. Why Nightfall? There are literally millions of short stories to pick from. So why this one? Because Asimov. That's one reason. Isaac Asimov has written this. An incredible science fiction author. One of the big names that is in that. So he has his name on it. It's something probably that's going to be worth examining. But also because nearly every list I looked up for the best sci-fi short stories included Nightfall. Many lists had it as the number one spot, and it often made it into the top five on almost every list that I looked at, looking at the best sci-fi short stories, Nightfall was on almost all of those lists. In fact, in 1968, the Science Fiction Writers of America voted Nightfall the best science fiction short story written prior to the 1965 establishment of the Nebula Awards, and included it in the Science Fiction Hall of Fame, Volume 1, including stories written from 1929 to 1964. So it was a book that included the greatest sci-fi stories of all time, and they voted Nightfall to be in there. So when looking at sci-fi short stories, it seemed like the place to start. But also, it's a story I almost didn't start with or examine at all. And why? Well, because it's just over 13,000 words long. So while it made the list for best sci-fi short stories in so many places, and while it was voted one of the best sci-fi short stories of all time before, one of the best sci-fi stories of all time, but also written, voted the best one before 1968, according to Science Fiction Writers of America, it is technically, according to the standards of the Hugo Awards, not a short story. So for me, that almost automatically disqualified it. I actually found out after already reading and preparing for this episode that it was nearly twice the length of a qualifying short story Hugo Award. So technically, this is a novelette. Well, then why are we looking at it? That's a good question. First of all, we're looking at it because it's worth discussing, and because I've already read it and began preparing for it and have been putting a lot of time and effort into looking at this, and also because the Hugo Awards pick an arbitrary number to say what is a short story and what is not. And that doesn't mean that I have to follow their guidelines. It doesn't mean that I have to do what they do or look at that and say, well, if they don't call this a short story, then I can't examine it here. No, they can do what they want, and I'm going to do what I want. And so we press on. But some of you, if you are Asimov fans, especially you might be saying, hold on, wait a minute. Nightfall was a novel written in 1990 by Asimov and Robert Silverberg. Well, yes, it was. But that novel was actually an expansion of the original short story Nightfall. And while Nightfall, the novel, was published in 1990, the first short story Nightfall was published 49 years earlier in 1941. We will, I just think that's incredible. So it started out as a short story in 1941, and then 49 years later, it becomes a novel written by Asimov and Robert Silverberg. Silverberg actually wrote most of this, but Asimov said that there is very little that he would have changed himself or that he would have done differently. So I think he had very little changes to make to what Silverberg did in writing the novel. And I have not read the novel. I read this novelette and enjoyed it. I think at some point I'll probably get around to the novel, but I've not done that yet. And as we've done in the past here, sometimes we get into the background of the authors, the directors, whatever it may be. We're not really going to get into much of a background of Asimov. We've already done that before in season 1, episode 11, when we looked at his novel, Foundation. So we're not going to get into that too much. If you want to know more about Asimov, you can go listen to episode 11 about his work, Foundation. But just a little background of the story before we dive in. But of course, spoiler warning, spoiler alert, and also go read the story. You can find it for free online. It's worth reading. It's not very long and it's worthwhile. I think you can also find it on YouTube to be able to listen to. It's worth listening to, and you're not going to have to commit a whole lot of time to it because it's not a whole novel. It's just that novelette. So I encourage you to go and to read that before you listen to this or listen to it on YouTube or something like that. Obviously, that's not necessary, but is encouraged. So for the background of the story, this was the 32nd story that Asimov had written, and he did so while a graduate at Columbia University. John W. Campbell, editor of Astounding Fiction magazine, asked Asimov to write a story based on a Ralph Waldo Emerson quote that the two of them had discussed. And here's the quote. If the stars should appear one night in 1,000 years, how would men believe and adore and preserve for many generations the remembrance of the city of God? I think that's a great quote. If the stars should appear one night in 1,000 years, how would men believe and adore and preserve for many generations the remembrance of the city of God? So I understand there that Emerson is calling the night sky, the stars, the city of God, where God lives, in the heavens, something along those lines that reflects God's glory. That's kind of the way that I take it. I don't know if Emerson intended that or not, but that's kind of the way that I take it and understand that. Campbell, however, disagreed with what Emerson had said. He thought that this would have the opposite effect on people, that it wouldn't make them look at the stars and in wonder and in awe and think that that's amazing if they came about once every 1,000 years. He thought it would make people go crazy. He thought it would make them go mad, and hence nightfall was born. So let's get started. Nightfall takes place on the planet Lagash, a planet that has 6 suns. And because of that, the planet only experiences night, only experiences darkness, once every 2,049 years. So every 2,049 years, there is a cycle where only one sun is shining, and that sun that is shining is blocked out by an eclipse, and so they have night. They have night for half a day, is what we read in the short story. So once every 2,049 years, they have night for half a day. The first character that we are introduced to is Aton 77. I'm not sure why there is a number, and the number's not always used in the name, but pretty much every character is introduced with a name and a number. I'm not really sure why they call him Aton 77 to start with, but every time else, he's just referred to pretty much as Aton. So that's just what it is. So Aton is the director at Sauer University for the observatory, and he is determined to leave a recording of the darkness and the aftermath that the darkness has. Now, Aton is doing this because it's believed that the darkness causes society to literally collapse. There's been archaeological evidence that once about every 2,000 years, so, you know, this eclipse happens and darkness comes every 2,049 years, and they have found archaeological evidence that about every 2,000 years, complete civilizations have disappeared from this planet Lagash. And it's happened 9 times, so it's not something that's happened once or twice. They have found archaeological evidence of society collapsing 9 times, each time about 2,000 years apart. And it's believed that the darkness, the nightfall, that half a day of darkness that comes every 2,049 years, that is what is to blame for the collapse of society that's been seen these 9 times. It's said that the darkness causes people to go mad from fear and claustrophobia. I thought that was interesting. That in this story, that darkness is associated with claustrophobia and nightfall, that they think that people, it feels like the world is closing in on them when they're dark, when it's dark out. So they have darkness and this claustrophobia as well. I'm not sure if that's really how it is in real life. So the fear of dark or night is called nycotobia. So that there is a real fear for that, a phobia for it. But here, they're not so much concerned about nycotobia. They're concerned about claustrophobia and that feeling of things getting smaller and collapsing as the dark comes away. So right away, it is just, and just giving a recap of the story and kind of what is going on in the background here and what is being set up, we see something that's familiar to the Bible, light and darkness. Here are just a few passages about light and darkness. Genesis 1, 4 through 5. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. So here in the creation account, we have God literally making light and dark, making the night and the day. In 2 Samuel 22:29, we read, "You, Lord, are my lamp. The Lord turns my darkness into light." And here we've gone from having a literal darkness and a literal light and having a figurative darkness and light. So often through the scriptures, sin and evil, things of this world are referred to as darkness, and God or Jesus, holiness, goodness, righteousness, those things are referred to as light. It's pretty easy to see that motif carry out throughout the scriptures. So here in 2 Samuel 22:29, "You, Lord, are my lamp. The Lord turns my darkness into light." And then in John 1:1-5. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life. And that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." So again, here we have this idea of Jesus being associated with light, shining that goodness, that holiness, that righteousness into a dark, sinful, fallen world. We see that motif of light and dark. So oftentimes in the Bible uses light and darkness in this way. It's not meant in literal terms like the people of Lagash are about to experience. They're about to experience literal darkness. But when we look at the Bible, it's often meant in a figurative or an allegorical kind of way where, again, light is God or Jesus, righteousness, goodness, holiness, and the dark is, you know, evil and sin and all those other things, things of this world that would go against God. Those are dark, and God is the one who is shining the light into that darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. So the people of Lagash are living in a bright world. Only one night half a day every 2049 years is their nightfall. But we here on Earth, we're living in a dark world. We're living in a dark world because we are living in a fallen, sinful world. Even when it's daytime, even when the light is shining in this world, it is still a dark world because it is a fallen, sinful world. But friends, take heart, because the darkness has not and will not overcome the light that is Jesus. Jesus is that light, and we as followers of Jesus, we as the church are to shine that light into the darkness that is this world. We reflect Jesus' light to the world. Just like the moon reflects the light of the sun into the world, we are not looking to create our own light. We're not looking to shine for ourselves. What we are looking to do is to reflect the light of the sun to the world. Just as the moon reflects the sun's light, that's what we want to do. We want to reflect the light of the Son of God, Jesus Christ, to the world. We want his light to shine on us and to be reflected so that people can see him and that he can be glorified. But the darkness has not overcome that light. The darkness has not overcome that light. And in the Bible, the light of this world is often contrasted to the darkness of this world. There's a common theme that thousands of years after the Bible is written, we can still understand. Light being contrasted to darkness, darkness being contrasted to light, Jesus shining the light that and the light into what is darkness, and that the darkness does not overcome it. So even though the Bible is written, you know, 2,000-ish years ago and longer, it's still written in a way that we can understand today and still makes sense to us. Back to the story, and the next character we meet is Theramon 762. He is a reporter for the Sorrow City Chronicle, which is a newspaper. He has come to the observatory where Eitan is going to record the events leading up to and after the darkness so that future generations can learn and know what the darkness did. At least they can know what the darkness did to the people of Sorrow. And Theramon is there to write a story about it for the newspaper. He's not 100% convinced these things are going to happen, and he's written some things that have been rather critical of the people of the observatory. So there's some friction between Theramon and Eitan because of these previous stories, with Theramon being critical. And Theramon even predicts that the darkness might not even have many effects on the planet or these different things that are going on. So there's some friction that is there between these two characters. But Theramon is ultimately allowed to stay because, well, if Eitan is right and society collapses, there'll be no one to read the story. So what difference does it really make? But if society doesn't collapse, Eitan is going to be ridiculed and made fun of regardless. If nothing, the darkness comes, nothing happens, everyone's going to laugh at him, whether there's a story in the newspaper or not. So figures out he doesn't really have a whole lot to lose by letting Theramon stay there and write the story if they survive long enough for the story to be written. So while Eitan and Theramon are discussing if Theramon can stay or not, we read this. Eitan's upturned face flushed redly in the sunlight. In just under 4 hours, he said, civilization as we know it comes to an end. It will do so because, as you see, Beta is the only sun in the sky. He smiled grimly. Print that. There'll be no one to read it. But if it turns out that 4 hours pass and another four and nothing happens? Asked Theramon softly. Don't let that worry you. Enough will happen. So here we see that Eitan is certain in his own personal eschatology. Now, eschatology is the branch of theology that deals with the end times, the things of the final event, the end of the world, the end of human life and existence as we know it. And it comes from the Greek word eschatos, meaning last. So what exactly are the end times? Well, eschatology deals with the end of the present age, human history, this world ending, God recreating a new world, the Antichrist coming, the return of Jesus, the tribulation, the rapture, battles, millennium, the final judgment, you know, all of those things. Well, all right, that was a lot, and that's a lot to unpack, and we're not going to have time to go in depth in eschatology today, but hopefully that day is coming. Well, we'll be able to do that on this podcast. But for now, let's look at what the people in Nightfall think is going to happen and what is going to bring about the end of civilization, darkness. Isn't that interesting? Keeping with the motif of light and darkness, Christians would understand that the light would be here, the return of Jesus, God's new creation, dwelling with God forever in heaven. We would think that those things here would be light, that maybe the what brings about the end of the world is light, not darkness. The light of Jesus coming back and establishing, a new heaven and a new earth and being able to live eternally with God. Maybe that would be a light. Maybe it's a light that brings about the end of the world, the light of God coming into the world. But here in Nightfall, it's darkness that brings about the end of society. So here the eschatology is different. It's not an ending to the creation and to the world and all those different things as we know it. What it is here is just an ending to a society. The ending to society is what they're looking at here, the end of civilization. Now, when we look at eschatology, we think of Jesus' return and subsequently creating a new heaven and a new earth. And that's what we kind of look at when we think of eschatology. But here in the story, really, they're just looking at the end of civilization, the collapse of that. And again, if we got into all there is about eschatology, this would be a multiple part episode because there is just so much to cover. And when it comes to theology, the most disagreed part of Christian theology, the most disagreed part of Christian theology among Christians is eschatology. You might think it's some other issues in the news or people have saying been looking at this or this issue or that issue, whatever it may be. But the most disagreed part of Christian theology among Christians is eschatology. It has to do with the end times. When will the return of Jesus happen? Will it be a pre-tribulation return? Will it be a mid-tribulation return? Will it be a post-tribulation return? All right. So I guess I do need to go into this just a little bit. I can't assume that everyone that is listening to this would know what I'm talking about and what we're going into here. So we're going to talk about this just a little bit. The tribulation is the 7-year reign of the Antichrist. So someone is going to come and be an Antichrist and is going to come and is going to look good and do some seemingly good things and make some peace across the world, only that's not going to last for very long. So he's going to set up a 7-year reign, this Antichrist that comes in the name of peace and can do some incredible, really amazing looking things, but then does not have good intentions. And then at one point is going to break that world peace and destruction and war and famine and all those kinds of things are going to come. So it's kind of like that wolf in sheep clothing that is coming here. So the tribulation has to do with the 7-year reign of the Antichrist. It's seen in the book of Daniel. And there are some different understandings of when Jesus will return in regards to the tribulation. Is he going to return before this 7-year reign? Is he going to return in the middle of it? Or is he going to return in the end of it? I have my own thoughts about that and what that will be. And again, I hope the episode is coming soon where we can discuss these kinds of things. But I'll just say that even in our disagreements about this, we could still have unity. So I think that, I'll just tell you, I think that the most evidence for a number of reasons through the scriptures and through understanding is really looking at the post-tribulation return of Jesus. I think that's when it's going to happen. That's what makes sense according to the scriptures. Primarily, a lot of that has to do with Jesus' return. So a lot of people look at Jesus will return and will rapture believers up, and then there will be some that will remain behind during this tribulation, and some will come to have faith in Jesus during that time, and then at the end of the tribulation, Jesus will come back for them. So that's not a second coming of Jesus, that's a third return of Jesus, and I don't think we see scriptural evidence for a third return of Jesus. And also, quite honestly, folks, when has God ever said, I'm going to get you out of the hardest part? Like there are going to be some suffering. There are going to be some terrible things that happen here, and you're not going to have to deal with any of it. Like that's not what Jesus did. Jesus didn't take the easy way out. Jesus didn't say, hey, I don't want to do this. Get me out of here before things get really bad. That's not what Jesus did. If you read the New Testament, Paul talks so much about suffering and rejoicing in suffering. The early church rejoiced in their suffering that they were considered worthy enough to suffer for Jesus Christ. So when I look at, and also pre-tribulation and mid-tribulation theologies are rather recent theologies. I mean, like within the last couple hundred years, these have kind of developed into beliefs and doctrines for some denominations and for some churches. And they have grown. And if there's a theological understanding or belief from the scriptures that's only a couple of hundred years old, automatically that should throw up some red flags for us. That should throw up some red flags. We look at this and say, how did the Christians then for the last 1800-ish years miss this? But you guys figured it out. Like, how did that happen? How can that be? So I think there's some problems with looking at a pre-tribulation or even a mid-trib tribulation rapture when Jesus comes. Now, would I hope that it would be pre-tribulation if I had to go through that? Sure. Like, I would hope that's when Jesus comes, but we can hope for the best, but we need to prepare for the worst. We need to be prepared and we need to look at that. And could you imagine being a pre-tribulation person and when the tribulation happens, you're still here? Like, what disappointment you must have. Like, no, Jesus, you're supposed to come take me out before all this. Now, I just think you're setting yourself up for disappointment, right? You are preparing for the best and you're hoping for the best. No, let's hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. And I think that post-tribulation is when Jesus comes back because there's only one return of Jesus, that second coming of Jesus and when things happen. And also just because it's a rather new theology. And there's some other reasons that I could get into and hopefully will at a longer time. But again, if you disagree with me on that, then that's okay. Like, that doesn't make us opposed. That doesn't make us enemies. It means we have a different understanding of this one doctrine of the return of when Jesus will happen. We still are agreeing that Jesus will come back. We're just disagreeing on when that will be. But ultimately, nobody knows the day or the hour. Jesus says that himself. So I say this, and I say, this is what my understanding is according to the scriptures, but I'm not taking a hard line in the sand and saying, you know, you have to be on this side and believe this. No, this is what I understand, but only God knows. And God's in charge, and God's the one who could do it. So I am going to hope for the best, but I'm going to prepare for the worst. So I didn't plan on saying all that. That wasn't in my notes, but I just thought that may be important, just kind of let you know where I'm at and how I feel about these things. And this is why eschatology is the most disagreed part of Christian theology among Christians, because we all have a different understanding of when these things will happen. But just because you have a different understanding than I do does not mean that we have to that we can't get along, that we can't be on the same page with all these other things, and that we cannot continue to even attend the same churches and things like that. So even though there's some disagreement, there is still unity. There's also this thing called the millennium, the thousand-year reign of Jesus. But is that a literal thousand-year reign of Jesus? Is that a figurative reign of Jesus? Are we living in that now as a figurative age, or is it in an age to come? You're going to find a lot of different people saying a lot of different things about this millennial period of Jesus and when he will reign and what that means. Again, a lot of disagreement going on about this. We agree that this is going to happen. We just disagree on whether it's literal, figurative, when and how it's going to happen. So there's lots of questions, and we're just scratching the surface here. There's lots of questions that would take us far away from discussing nightfall. So we're only skimming the surface a little bit here, kind of like a rock skipping across the water. And as it hits the water, you know, that we're kind of only hitting on certain points here as we look at this, But in the end, spoiler alert again, Jesus wins. We know the ending to the book. We know how the book ends in Jesus wins. God is victorious. That's the end of the book. And that we, as followers of him, we are co-heirs with Christ, and we too can be victorious as Jesus has been victorious. So even if there's some disagreement with these other understandings of eschatology and what is going on, we all have the hope that Jesus is victorious and that we can share in that victory too. Thanks be to God. Back to the story, and something worth discussing. There's something worth discussing in a conversation between Theramon and Aiton. Theremin says, "My columns may have been a little rough, but I gave you people the benefit of the doubt every time. After all, this is not the century to preach the end of the world is at hand to Lagash. You have to understand that people don't believe the Book of Revelations anymore. And it annoys them to have scientists turn about face and tell us if the cultists, are right after all." "No such thing, young man," interrupted Aiton. "While a great deal of our data has been supplied by the cult, our results contain none of the cult's mysticism. Facts are facts, and the cult's so-called mythology has certain facts behind it. We've exposed them and ripped away their mystery. I assure you that the cult hates us now worse than you do." So we see here that Theremon mentions the Book of Revelations and the cult or the cultists. At first, I thought that Asimov was going to make it so that Christians have turned into a cult. I thought that's what was going to happen, right? Because we have a Book of Revelation, and here they're making a reference to a Book of Revelation and also to the cult or cultists. However, that was not the case. And we later hear quotes from the references to the cult's Book of Revelation, and some of these references say things such as the myth of the stars, which happens every 2,050 years, and that's, you know, when Lagash goes into darkness and people see the stars, and that robs them of their souls and leaves them unreasoning brutes, and things like that is what some people think. Is what the Book of Revelation for the cultists says about what happens during the darkness. And then there's quotes such as this: "And it came to pass that those days the sun Beta held long vigil in the sky for ever longer periods as the revolutions passed, until such a time as for full half a revelation it alone, shrunken and cold, shone down upon Lagash. And also, from the stars there then reached down the heavenly flame, and where it touched, the cities of Lagash flamed to utter destruction, so that of man and of the works of man naught remained." So those are some quotes or some ideas that either people either think are in the cultists, scripture, the Book of Revelation, or actually is quoted the cultists' Book of Revelation, not the Book of Revelation from the Bible. So those are ideas that are not in the Bible. So the cultists are not Christian. So I was pleased by that, because Christianity, well, let me clarify here, Orthodox Christianity, when lived and practiced properly, is not a cult. Now, there have been many people who have taken Christianity and added a little something to it, or changed it in this way, or taken something away, and they have used some Christian principles to form a cult. But that's not a Christian cult, because as soon as you add something to Christianity, as soon as you change it up a little bit, as soon as you take something away from it, as soon as you do those different kinds of things that affect the beliefs, the doctrine, the practice, the scriptures, as soon as you do something that changes those things, it ceases to be Christian. So you can't have a Christian cult, because Christians are not. We do not belong to a cult. We are not a cult. We are not a part of that. But when something happens, there can be a cult that is based on Christian principles, but that does not make them Christian just because they claim to be, or just because they say that that's what they are based on. What then is a cult? Well, in doing research for this, I stumbled across an article on the website The Tennessean, and I thought the opening line of their article, "What Makes a Cult," was worth sharing with you. So here's the headline of the story: "How can you tell if a group is a cult or not?" Listen to this. This is how they started it. "After a recent report about a cat-worshipping end times group in Middle Tennessee, we asked cult expert Janja Lalich to explain what makes a cult." Yes, you heard that right. A cat-worshipping end times group in Middle Tennessee. So, of course, I had to click on the link to that story, and it took me to an article so brilliantly titled "Apocalypse Meow." That got a good chuckle out of me. "Apocalypse Meow: How a Cult Believes That Cats Are Divine, How a Cult Believes Cats Are Divine Beings Ended Up in Tennessee." Well, as you might imagine, this cult has some rather strange beliefs about cats carrying human souls to heaven, and I don't know what else. It was a surprisingly long article, and I did not read all of it. But part of their belief is that cats carry the souls of people to heaven. Yeah, that's what they are. But according to Janja Lalich, cult expert and professor emeritus of sociology at California State University, Chico, a cult is a group or movement held together by a shared commitment to a charismatic leader or ideology. It has a belief system that has the answers to all of life's questions and offers a special solution to be gained only by following the leader's rules. It requires a high level of commitment from at least some of the members. I'm not really sure I love that definition. I'm not necessarily sure that that's a great definition of what a cult is. So according to the International Cultic Studies Association, a cult is an ideological organization held together by charismatic relations and demanding total commitment. In a cult, the normal process of social influence from the leader becomes extreme or harmful to the group. This shift can lead to observable psychological trauma to many people in the cult. The cause of this harm is often the above normal level of demand and social control by one leader over the group. This intense process is often known as the cult dynamic. So is Christianity a cult? Well, no. Let's look at four characteristics that cults employ according to Stephen Hassan's book, Combating Cult Mind Control. The first thing that cults do is behavior control. An individual's associations, their living arrangements, their food, their clothing, their sleeping habits, their finances, their career, their family situation, and on it goes, the behavior of the person in the cult is strictly controlled. Now, when it comes to Christianity, the Bible and most churches and denominations have standards for all the things listed above. They have standards on how you should live in regards to these things, how you should, what your living arrangements should be, what is proper clothing to wear, what are some good habits that you should have, what should you do with your finances, how should you behave in your career, all these different things. There are standards to these things, but I have never been a part of a church or heard of a Christian church who enforces these things to the point that it punishes the members when these things are not followed, when it punishes them when things are not followed. Now, churches do not demand that you hand over the information to your checking account and that you sell all of your possessions and proceeds to give to the leader. Cults do that. You have to hand over your banking account and all this information. You have to sell what you have and give me the money. That happens in cults to the leader. That is not what we do. Now, Christians believe that there are ways to live regarding these things that are listed above, but none control things in the way that, say, Jim Jones of Jonestown controlled these things for the members of his cult, or the way that Marshall Applewhite controlled the things for the members of his cult with Heaven's Gate. We don't demand that people cut their hair and wear the same kind of clothes and move to another country and can only do this kind of work. Like, we move to a commune on another country where you can only do this kind of work. We don't give orders to go and shoot senators because they come down to check on people that they don't think are doing well. Like, that is not what Christianity does. We don't have that kind of control over people. We believe that there are standards for behavior, but to control them in the way that cults control them, we do not do that. We believe that there are standards, and if you're going to live according to these standards, this is what you should do, but we do not control them to the point that cults control them. The second thing, according to Hassan, is that cults control information. Cult leaders deliberately withhold or distort information, or they lie or limit the access of information or propagandize. If this is what a church is doing, then we must immediately dismiss them as a Christian church, because we are people of truth, not manipulation. Again, no church that I know of or has been a part of would do this. Churches I've been a part of would encourage people actually to go and search and learn and see what is true. And go and see what is true and to explore this. Contrary to popular cultural opinion, I have never heard a pastor stand in front of a pulpit and say, you should only be watching Fox News. Doesn't happen. That's not what we do as Christians. We don't look there and say, you should only be looking to these media sources to get your information. And if you look anywhere else, then that's a lie. I've never heard that from the pulpit. I've never heard of a Christian leader saying, of a pastor saying those things and preaching that to his people. That is not what we do. If you want information, go seek information. Go try to get it. Because we know what and who is true and what leads to truth. And we're not scared of that. We're not scared of false information. We're not scared of lies because we worship the God of truth. Now, we want to avoid lies. We want to do all those different kinds of, but we're not scared of them. We're not intimidated. No, that's not the way it is. And we as Christians, we do not distort. We do not withhold things. We don't lie. We don't try to access the information of other people. We don't do that. We do not have that. Again, that comes down to behavior control, and Christians do not have that. Pastors, leaders of the church do not have that kind of control over the parishioners. Now, cult leaders have that kind of control over the people within their cult, but not so within the church. Hassan's third thing that cults employ is thought control. Cult leaders use loaded words and language. They discourage critical thinking. They bar any speech that's critical of the cult leader or their policies. Then they teach an us versus them doctrine. Again, churches that I know of and churches that I've been a part of would actually encourage critical thinking. They would encourage learning and people to participate in Bible studies or small groups or committee meetings where they can voice their opinion. And sometimes that opinion disagrees with the pastor. And that's okay. They don't get kicked out. They don't get excommunicated. They don't get punished for that. That's okay. They can have their own thoughts. They can have their own opinions as we have discussions on committee meetings. And while there is a Christian mentality of being in the world but not of the world, we do not have an us against them mentality or that us against them kind of mentality when it comes to Christians and people who are not. We are not against them. Whoever them is, I don't necessarily feel comfortable with saying that kind of language. We're not against people who are not Christians. We're actually trying to get them to join our team. That's what we want to do. We want to show them love and grace and compassion and kindness as we go and love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us. And what the goal is not to get you out or to be against you. The goal is to get you to join the team. That's the ultimate goal. So we're not out here trying to employ this thought control where we need to be against people and we need to be fighting people. That's not what Christians do. That's not what the church does. Hassan's fourth thing is that cults have emotional control over their people. The leaders manipulate their followers via fear, including fear of losing salvation, fear of shunning, guilt, indoctrination, those kinds of things. Again, while Christians have standards for living, and especially standards for those who are in leadership, I've never been a part of a church or heard of a church where they are told they need to do this or that, or else they're going to be kicked out of church and lose their salvation. If a church is telling you you need to do this or that, whatever it is, and if you don't do this or that, then we are going to kick you out and you have lost your salvation, there should be some red flags that are flying up there. Because first of all, the church does not control your salvation. And that's not the way that we should go about. And if somebody is in a sinful situation where they're doing something that is wrong, and it may be open and sinful that they're doing something wrong, this is not the way that the Bible tells us to handle that situation. They don't just tell us that, oh, you see them doing something wrong, so get them out of there as soon as you can and scare them that they're going to go to hell if they do. No, that we don't find that anywhere in the scriptures. There are standards that need to be lived by, and if they're not being lived up biblically, then some people do need to be removed from leadership, but there's often a restorative process that you can go through. And we don't just kick people out who have made mistakes and kick them out forever and pretend like they never existed and condemn them to hell as if some person could actually do that anyway. That's not what we do. We do have standards of behavior, standards for the way that people act, especially people in leadership. But we don't control them and have this emotional abuse and fear over them. That is not what the church does. It's just simply not. So when Christianity is properly practiced, it is not a cult. Not even close. But when one leader starts to add things to Christianity or take away or change it, whatever it may be, then a cult can develop, but that's not a Christian cult because of the point of adding or taking things away or changes to Christianity has made it no longer Christian. Another problem with Christianity being a cult is that who is the current on earth leader of the church? Perhaps if you're a Catholic, you would say the Pope, but if you're not, then who is it? There isn't one. But every cult has an on-earth leader that is in charge and making solo decisions and enforcing rules and regulations like we've just discussed. A single leader on earth right now making those choices. I suppose maybe if you're part of an independent church, you know, a non-denominational kind of deal that has no oversight or accountability, one person could have that kind of control, and that has happened. But that's usually not the case in what goes on. And when those kinds of things do happen, there is some danger in what can develop and what can happen. And things can become very cult-like in that situation as things may be added or taken away or changed that makes things no longer Christian. So simply put, Christianity is not a cult. It doesn't fit the criteria. It doesn't work. So I'm happy here that Asimov is not calling the cultists Christians, because Christianity is not a cult. Back to the story, and another character is introduced, Binet 25, who is the telephotographer at the observatory. Binet is in favor of allowing Theramon to cover the story just in case they're wrong and society doesn't end. They'll need some documenting of what happened and how they were wrong and what they could learn from it. Then we also meet another character, Sharon 501, who's a psychologist at Sarah University, and who tells us there's a hideout that some people will go to that will shield them from the darkness and the collapse of society so that they will be able to rebuild. And Sharon has a conversation with Theramon in which Sharon tells him that it is fire that has destroyed the previous 9 civilizations. The darkness comes, people go mad because it's dark out, and they want light. They are yearning for that light that they've always had, so they end up burning everything on the planet down in an attempt to get light. What an impatient people. The darkness only lasts half a day, 12-ish hours, let's say. I don't know how long a day is on Lagash, but let's say 12-ish hours. So all they would need to do is endure darkness for 12 hours, once every 2,049 years, and they would be fine. But they can't do it. They can't handle it. Darkness comes, and just after a few minutes, they go crazy and want the light back and start burning things down. What an impatient people these Lagashians are. But Sharon also explains that that it's been found that the Lagashians go mad or even die from panic, from sheer terror and panic, after being in darkness for only 15 minutes. For only 15 minutes, some of them go crazy or even die due to the panic and the fear that is there. So for them, looking at hours of darkness would be catastrophic. But still, you only have to do it once every 2,049 years, and they can't handle even hours of darkness. What an impatient people. In this, we also see the low value that Sharon and others place on human life. So when talking about this darkness and the kind of it was this ride that people were put on that they could, kind of like an amusement park ride where they were put on where they could go in darkness, but it was also really an experiment to see what would happen. So when he's talking about these people who have been in darkness for 15 minutes and some of them have died, here's what Sharon says. The psychologist snorted. Bah, 2 or 3 died. That was nothing. They paid off the families of the dead ones and argued the, you know, Jongler City Council into forgetting it. Jongler City is where this experiment, where this ride took place. Such a low value on life. It's only 2 or 3 dead. No big deal. They paid them off. It was fine. Nothing to worry about. That is such a low value on life, because life is more valuable than that. Something else from the Theramon and Sharon conversation that is worth reading and discussing. Sharon says, imagine darkness everywhere. No light as far as you can see. The houses, the trees, the fields, the earth, the sky, black. And stars thrown in for all I know. Whatever they are, can you conceive it? So they really don't understand what stars are either. They really don't get that and what it is. Because again, 2,049 years, no one has really seen that. So can you really conceive it? Yes, I can, declared Theramon, truancently. That's like aggressively, self-assuredly. Yes, I can, declared Theramon, self-assured. And Sharon slammed his fist down upon the table in sudden passion. You lie! You can't conceive that. Your brain wasn't built for the conception any more than it was built for the conception of infinity or of eternity. You can only talk about it. Oh, I think there may be some truth in that. That our brains perhaps was not built for the conception of infinity or eternity. How can we, as temporal beings, to which there is a beginning and end for everything in life, how can we as temporal beings fully understand and explain he who is without a beginning or an end? How can we explain that which is eternal, which will have no start, which will have no end? This age-old question, where did God come from? God has always been. He's always been there. How does a being always be? He just does. Kind of reminds us of Aquinas' unmoved mover, where everything in the universe is put into motion, but eventually you have to go back to there's something that was not put in motion, who's the one who was not set into motion, but set the other things into motion. And Aquinas calls that the unmoved mover, who is God. But how do you explain that which is eternal with a temporal mindset? I don't know. I don't have a great way to explain it, but I believe it to be true. Back to the story. In one of the cultists, Latimer 25, he gets into the observatory with the intention of destroying equipment and cameras because he doesn't view the darkness as a bad thing. He actually views this darkness as a good thing. But he also sees all this equipment as blasphemy because he understands that the scientific study is taking away the religious significance of the stars. So if they're looking here and they're saying that scientifically you can prove that there's a pattern to the rotation of the suns and planets that explains why there is a 2049-year cycle of darkness for one night, then it's no longer supernatural, but you've explained it naturally. And for the cultists, there's a problem because science is proving their religious beliefs wrong. That this isn't something that is supernatural, but this is something that's just a part of the natural way that the Lagash in this universe is ordered. But Eitan believes that he has actually proved the essential creed of the cult through his scientific understanding. He thinks that science has proved these beliefs, but for the cultists, if they are natural explanations, then it hasn't proved anything. But let me tell you, friends, God can and does work through the natural process of the universe. Just because there is a natural process does not mean that God is not at work. Again, he is the one who has put this natural process into order. But again, here we have our old friend, science versus religion. And if you've previously listened, you know how I feel about this. That science is not against religion, that religion is not against science, but the two can work together. The two can have a relationship of integration, not of opposition or ignoring one another. Science, true science, always illuminates who God is and how God works. And when we do theology properly, we can look at theology, and theology can help science understand the way that things work, the way that things have been put in place, and the order that things have happened with that can also illuminate our understanding of God and the way the universe is. If you want to know more about the relationship between science and religion, you can go back and listen to episode 3 on Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles for a more in-depth discussion where we discuss those things. Back to the story, and actually, it's not really the darkness that Latimer is looking forward to, but it's actually seeing the stars, because he believes that seeing the stars leads to salvation. The salvation of his soul depends on seeing those stars. So he actually, at one point, doesn't give the others too much trouble because they threaten to lock him in a closet, so he'll be trapped there in the darkness when the stars come out, and he will not be able to be saved. What a strange way to be saved. You just got to look at the stars, and his soul can be saved. That's strange. Well, according to Christians, what is the understanding of salvation? And here we're about to enter into soteriology. The study of salvation, coming from the Greek word soteria, meaning salvation. So we call the study of salvation soteriology. And to look at this, to understand what Christians mean by salvation, listen in part to what the First Ecumenical Council of Nicaea in 325 AD wrote. So this is also known as the Nicene Creed. "We believe in one Lord, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the only begotten of his Father, of the substance of the Father, God of God, light of light, very God of very God, begotten, not made, being of one substance with the Father, by whom all things were made, both which be in heaven and in earth, who for us men and for our salvation came down from heaven and was incarnate and made man. He suffered, and the third day he rose again and ascended into heaven, and he shall come to judge both the quick and the dead." Salvation starts with Jesus and the work that he does. Who for us people, who for humanity, and for our salvation, Jesus came down from heaven and was incarnate and made human. He came down for our salvation. The work of salvation starts with Jesus, and it ends with Jesus, because we as people, we do not save ourselves. Salvation is the work of Jesus. We as people just have to accept the gift that he offers, that gift of salvation that Jesus is offering. We need to be saved from sin. We're in a fallen world, and all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. So what do we need to be saved from? What do we need a savior for? What do we need salvation from? Sin. We all need to be saved because we've all fallen short of the glory of God. We've all sinned. So we need a savior. And Jesus saves us through his birth, life, death, resurrection, and ascension. Through those things, how Jesus was born, the perfect life that he lived, the death that he had, the resurrection from the dead, and ascending into heaven, because Jesus has done those things, we can be saved. Because of Jesus and the personal union of deity and humanity in Jesus, that is the basis upon which salvation is brought to humanity. Jesus is the mediator, the go-between for people and God, and salvation is all about accepting what Jesus has done for us so that we can be forgiven of our sins, so that we can have a relational change with God, where we can go from being distant to God to being close to God, and we can have a real change within us where we are reborn, and we have a new life within us, that we are a new person following after and chasing the ways of God. We can be saved because of what Jesus has done for us. That is the Christian understanding of salvation, that we need to be saved from sin, and that salvation, we can have salvation because of what Jesus has done for us. The work of Christ has made it so that we can be saved. That mediating work of the personal union of the deity and humanity of Jesus. Thanks be to God. Back to the story, and there is magnificent writing as the sun is slowly being eclipsed and the darkness is coming. And at one point, we read this as the discussion has turned to different planets and what would and would not sustain life in those kinds of things. And I've got another cute little notion, Benet said. Have you ever thought what a simple problem gravitation would be if only you had a sufficiently simple system? Supposing you had a universe in which there was a planet with only one sun. The planet would travel in a perfect ellipse, and the exact nature of the gravitational force would be so evident it could be accepted as an axiom. Astronomers on such a world would start off with gravity probably before they even invented the telescope. Naked eye observation would be enough. But would such a system be dynamically stable? Questioned Sharon doubtfully. Sure, they call it the one-in-one case. It's been worked out mathematically, but it's the philosophical implications that interest me. It's nice to think about, admitted Sharon, as a pretty abstract, like a perfect gas or absolute zero. Of course, continued Benet. There's the catch that life would be impossible on such a planet. It wouldn't get enough heat and light, and if it rotated, there would be total darkness half of each day. You couldn't expect life, which is fundamentally dependent upon light, to develop under those conditions. Besides, and then he's interrupted. But that's just the point that we wanted to look at there. And what's really interesting to me is this one and one. It's been worked out mathematically. It could happen. But really what interests me are the philosophical implications. the implications of such a planet, the one in one, the one planet, one star, the implication is that such a perfect planet, such a fine-tuned planet must have been by design, not by chance. They look at this planet and say that the chances of a one in one being able to support life is so crazy that it couldn't happen. But if it did, what are those philosophical implications? That there is something that has put that there intentionally, that there has been an intelligent designer that has made this and has made it the way that it's supposed to be, that has fine-tuned, if you will, the planet to support life. Again, we've looked at these before, these anthropic principles, how this planet is so finely tuned to be able to support life and life as we know it. In the story, the darkness continues to approach, and all seem to be fearful of it, all but Latimer. And all seem to be driven a little crazier as well. Sharon and Theramon start to panic with the night coming and are nailing themselves into the observatory to save them from the crowds that they think are becoming crazy, so they can't even see the crowds in the city, but they're sure those people are becoming crazy, so they're becoming a little crazier. But Latimer wants to get out. He needs to see the stars, so he tries to escape, but Theramon, worried he will break out and compromise the security of the observatory, Theramon attacks Latimer, and he strangles him. And as Latimer dies, he is looking up at the stars. And we see the remaining people in the observatory descend into madness as darkness covers Lagash. And we read, someone clawed at the torch as it fell and snuffed out. And in the instant, the awful splendor of the indifferent stars leaped nearer to them. On the horizon outside the window in the direction of Sorrow City, a crimson glow began growing, strengthening in brightness. That was not the glow of a sun. The long night had come again. That's the end of the story. Perhaps there's some self-fulfilling prophecy here with the darkness. The darkness is going to make everyone crazy when it comes. It actually has, because that's what they've expected. So perhaps there is some self-fulfilling prophecy here. But that does it for the novelette Nightfall by Isaac Asimov, where we've discussed light and darkness imagery in the Bible, eschatology, cults, and why Christianity is not a cult, salvation, and more. This has been a fun story to read here. It kind of leaves you with this cliffhanger ending. So my understanding is the novel picks up just a little bit before this and then really kind of talks about the after effects that have happened after this. And again, I haven't read that. But I would like to at some point and to be able to do that. But I like this story. I can understand why this story would make the list of some of the best science fiction short stories, if you want to classify it as a short story. I understand why it would make that list. But thank you for listening today, and it is good to be back with you. I would love to hear from you and what you think about this, and if you got a chance to read this, or if you got a chance to listen to it. What did you think? What did I miss? What did I not go over well enough? Whatever it may be, whether it's criticism, whether it's just some comments or some questions or whatever it may be that you have, I would love to hear from you because it's good to be back here with you. So again, you can find me on social media at Theology and Sci-Fi, the podcast on Facebook, on Twitter and Instagram. It's just Theology and Sci-Fi, and email is theologyandscifi@gmail.com. And of course, we spell sci-fi the correct way around here, SCIFI. So that's how we spell sci-fi. So thanks for listening, and tell a friend, and look for things to discuss when you are watching TV shows or watching movies or reading books or short stories, whatever it may be. Look for the themes that are there that you can be able to use as a vehicle to be able to discuss these things with your friends and hopefully be able to introduce them to who Jesus is. Well, what did you think of this episode? Again, I'd love to hear from you. Next episode, I'm not exactly sure yet where we'll be. I hope to look at a TV show episode. We'll see. So if you have a science fiction TV show that you would want me to take a look at, I would love to hear from you. Suggestions are open. If you have a specific TV show, I can just pick an episode from it. Or if you have a specific episode you'd like me to take a look at, just reach out to me through one of those ways and let me know. Again, thanks for listening. Truly do appreciate it. It's fun to watch these numbers grow and all the international listeners It truly is fun, and I enjoy this, and I thank you for it. And I would greatly appreciate it if you would just tell a friend or two if you are enjoying this podcast. And transitioning to short stories and to TV episodes, hopefully these podcast episodes will be a little bit shorter. This one, maybe our shortest one yet. I can't remember, but we're not. It's got to be our shortest one. So that's probably going to happen as well. As we look at short stories and TV episodes, they're not going to be as long. So they're going to be shorter, which may be easier to listen to and hopefully also easier to prepare. But I still think that the content is going to be there in terms of what we're looking at and what we're understanding and what we're being able to use to be able to grow. I love using the vehicle of science fiction to be able to talk about theology with you. So thank you. Thank you again for listening. For Theology and Sci-Fi, I am Derek V. Trout. Aton 77 found his voice. And though it trembled with restrained emotion, the careful, somewhat pedantic phraseology, for which the famous astronomer was noted, did not abandon him.